I think it would be inaccurate to say fresh from an Easter vigil, but at least having recently arrived from from an Easter vigil. Dang, that service is long. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, and it was a very lovely service. It's about my fourth this week, so I'm a little behind the eight ball when it comes to our guest tonight. I usually like to read through the entire book cover to cover before I have the guest on. I'll have to make it up to her in other ways. We're talking about the male brain tonight on Coast to Coast, and we're going to get into the topic right away. So first, let me be the first to wish you a happy Easter, if that's what you're celebrating. I hope you've had a happy Passover since earlier in the week, or spring solstice, or whatever it is that you're celebrating, just maybe perhaps a collegiate spring break. Whatever the case is, I hope you're going to make the most of it and enjoy whatever ritual it is that you do about this time of year. Start of baseball season, that's as good as any. New Twins ballpark open. Target Field getting rave reviews. Outdoor baseball sounds fun. But whatever it is, just know, too, that it's been a draining week for me, so I don't have a blog this week, and I don't have crypto news prepared for tonight. I did, however, put up on at where the usual blog post is at Coast to Coast AM, a quick joke appropriate for the Easter table for tomorrow. You could also use it at the Passover table, too, to be totally honest. It's a completely harmless, in good fun religious joke. And take a look online at coasttocoastam.com and click onto the blog. It may come in handy in the next 24 hours or more. Coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, George Norrie is going to be on talking about the Shroud of Turin. That's only appropriate tonight. It's hard to imagine a subject that doesn't bring us back to an understanding of the human brain. In the tragedies of war and violence, the way that human beings are wired, lead us to the brink of killing each other and sometimes going through with it. In the aftermath of destruction, too, understanding how the complexities of the brain can explain how we can help warriors and victims alike readjust to society and living productive lives. Throw a bowling ball at a newspaper. And, well, at first you got to find a newspaper, but then you'll find the after effect of poor brain maintenance, cranial distress, in the form of car and motorcycle accidents, for example, sports injuries, many intentionally risky behaviors with which we struggle as human beings to both understand why we do them and how we recover from them. Alcohol and other drug abuses impact the way the human brain works in ways that we still don't fully understand, and not just biochemically, but also in the way that we condition our brains, right? The way in which our brains become accustomed to functioning or dysfunctioning. And central to so many news stories that are affecting our lives, it's specifically the male brain that appears to drive bad decision making with cruel consequences. For example, it's one thing to talk about the priest sex abuse scandals of both children and adolescents, for that matter, men and women, in terms of these men being evil, right, or being pawns of Satan. Somebody said that in the Vatican, that, you know, this is a story about priests being taken over by the devil. But I think the real scary story is that this is not something that comes in from the outside. That the poor decisions we make and some of the tragic consequences come entirely from the way in which the male brain can be wired. And understanding the male brain will both help men be better men and to better understand their impulses, but also help women understand just how hard it is sometimes to be a guy. I'm not asking for women out there to send in any sympathy cards, and women have their own challenges in the female brain. But tonight we're going to be talking about the male brain. We're going to talk about how it is that we can understand both how men and boys think. What is the hard wiring and what are some of the software options that are available to us, and how that keeps impacting the news, how we can see ourselves in these tragic stories and keep ourselves from actually being in them. Next, on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Luann Brizendine is also the author of the book on the female brain, but the new book, The Male Brain, A Breakthrough Understanding of How Men and Boys Think, is coming in the nick of time, or centuries too late, depending on how we look at it, but it'll be very helpful either way. Good evening, Doctor.
Hi, nice to be with you and your audience tonight.
Thank you. And let's start by, if you would, since we're talking about the male brain, let's separate out what are the defining characteristics that are different about male brains versus female brains, and then we'll explore more about what those differences mean in real life terms.
We know we all start off at conception for the first 8 weeks with female type brain circuits until 8 weeks, when those tiny testicles in the male fetus pump out lots of testosterone and it marinates the male brain, changing the brain circuits into male.
I love that word, marinate. I don't think the word that people were expecting, but it's probably perfectly, it's a perfect description. It kind of pickles the brain a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's actually a fertilizer. It kind of fertilizes the brain and actually makes certain areas grow larger in the male brain. For example, down in the deep in the brain, the area for sexual pursuit, that is a technical term, by the way, the area for sexual pursuit. It's deep in the hypothalamus, and it gets to be 2.5 times larger in the male brain than in the female brain.
Now, we say in the male brain or in the female brain. Do we mean typical? Because it would seem to imply, it would seem like there are some women out there who have that enlarged portion of their brain who also have perhaps the same insatiable or consistent interest in sex as men. No?
Yeah. So if you think about it, if you said you couldn't say all women are shorter than men or all men are taller than women, right?
Right.
So there are certain numbers of women who are taller than some men. So you've got that, you do have that spectrum. And of course, this is the typical average man has the 2.5 time larger area for sexual pursuit. And of course, you know, in other mammals, for example, in rodents, it's 7.0 times larger in the male than the female.
But in the women who have that larger, that part of their brain as large as a typical male, are they characterized in the same way? Do they tend to follow the same behaviors?
We know we haven't studied that yet. The area of studying sex differences in the brain is fairly new, and new technology pushes the field further. In the last 10 years, we've had very sophisticated MRI scans and different technology to look at that, but they haven't ever really followed a woman that has an area that's that long, and followed her behavior.
That long. They were talking about the male brain. Dr. Luann Brizendine is our guest. All right, so then after the brain is marinated just so, with just the right amount of testosterone, typically, what other characteristics become different then about the male brain from a female brain, typical female brain?
So then, you know, by the time we're all born, we have those circuits that are specific for our gender. And male brains, when a boy is born, he actually has circuitry that's going to end up making him, and his teen years, when the testosterone then resurges from 9 to 15 years old, by the way, it goes up 20-fold. That's like 200 to 250% in the boy. That starts running all of those circuits for the male brain and starts to have about 13, 14 years old. The boy starts to have fantasies, let's say, about female body parts.
Right.
And then he starts to enter into his lifelong sexual pursuit of the female.
So, again, typical for this, I think you used a description in the book in which you said that a boy at 9 years old gets the equivalent of one cup of, we looked at testosterone as a cup of beer. What was the analogy? How did that work?
Yeah, if the boy at 9 years old has one cup of beer, then by the time he's 15, he's drinking close to 2 gallons.
That's the amount of testosterone that comes into the system.
Yeah, increase. It's huge, like a tsunami of testosterone.
Comes in by the time he's 15, he's getting 2 gallons. And so then, you know, there are women, and I have worked with some over the years, although not recently, thank God, but there's a period of time where it was kind of a popular notion that men were defective women.
Right? That's been for the last 30 years, of course. That's how, you know, that's my generation. I will take it. I was an undergraduate and a feminist at UC Berkeley in the 1970s. And, you know, all of my group of women, we thought men were the enemy, of course, you know, because right. you guys were keeping us down. And then, right. you know, over time, I think that what's also happened, you know, all of us women decided that when we had boys of our own, we were going to raise them with gender-neutral toys, and we were going to raise them to be sensitive husbands, and our future right. daughters-in-law would thank us for raising these sensitive men, right?
Yeah. And then that didn't work out quite like, right, as you all were expecting.
Yeah, and, you know, and I think in the school systems, what's also happened is that, you know, the boys learn by wiggling, like I talk about in the first chapter of the book. There's a lot of what's called embodied cognition, if you will. Let me explain what that means. It's a technical term. It means that, for example, when a boy learns to read the word R-U-N, run, he actually activates his leg muscles for running, and it's part of the way his brain learns that word. It's called embodied cognition, embodied learning. Of course, girls do that too, but boys need to do it a lot more. They describe math problems. They can actually tell you how they got the answer without even using a single word, just by gesturing. So they're a different style of learning in the classroom for boys. But sadly, of course, that has been, you know, it's been the little girl who sits quietly and does her work and turns in her work and doesn't run around the classroom and doesn't wiggle that gets all of the kudos from right, the classroom. And of course, it's mostly female teachers in the grade schools anyway. Fortunately, there's more and more men coming into the teaching profession in the grade schools. But, you know, I think everybody, all your listeners out there know that, you know, it's a tough road to hoe for a little boy in a modern classroom.
It was very much like that for my boys. I have two boys, and they're both teenagers now. One going to be going off to college, and
They're drinking the beer.
Oh yeah, tell me about that. Fortunately, it's right now all they're overdosing on is testosterone. But there are lots of behaviors that we know are being driven by that. Because just even since you mentioned the testosterone, I think it was about 6 months ago that our oldest one just started saying spontaneously, "Oh, I wish I could get into a fight tonight." And it was so, and my wife was like shocked that he would say that, but I knew exactly what he meant. You know, it just sort of, and he didn't, God bless him, he was able to hold that back. But it was interesting that he was processing that thought out loud, and it was all about a testosterone surge, don't you think?
Yeah, so, you know, I think in the second chapter of the book, The Teen Boy Brain, I have lots of moms especially. I'm glad you brought this up about the difference between you and your wife and yeah. Because I think when dads hear that kind of stuff, they get it. They get it at a deep level. They remember it. It doesn't seem like their son is going off the deep end.
No.
It's just something that happens with one of those testosterone surges. Yeah. And there can be irritability and hostility. And like, but a lot of us women, my son is 19 too. So he's just gone through this stage while I'm writing the Male Brain book. And he, you know, I remember that as well. But moms, it's shocking to us that our little boys end up saying things like that or doing things like that. And, you know, they spend a lot of time behind closed doors, don't they?
Yeah, and yet at the same time, and again, you know, we have, like, filters on the computers and other stuff, and we keep generally checking. We're pretty happy with the trade-offs. And then every once in a while, you know, one of them will say, "We're going out to shoot, you know, airsoft pellet guns, and you don't try to stop us," you know, and I don't, but, you know, we know that there's a certain things they've got to go do, and it's an active thing, and they've got to kind of get it out of their system. And so it is a
little weird. I went through the years of driving him to the paintball.
There you go.
The range for paintball.
Exactly. Where that's his graduation present this year. It's going to be a paintball range with his friends.
So, exactly. So, yeah. You know, and so us moms, you know, you go through it and you learn from your sons. But I think that, you know, as I describe in the teen boy brain part, this change is, I think, also a little bit shocking to the boys. And I remember, you know, talking, boys at 13, 14, when they start sometimes to have these sexual thoughts, which are normal, and that's what the testosterone is making them do, they don't know that other guys yet are thinking the same thoughts, and they're sort of alone with those thoughts.
Well, in to go back to that primary thought, we had a couple of the teachers they had were, and fortunately not recently, but early on, were very focused on punishing the boys in the classroom for essentially being boys. They wouldn't sit still. There was a list up on the blackboard of the kids who were on, I forgot the word, it was essentially double secret probation, but I can't remember what it was, but they had a list like the don't be boy, the don't be list and the good be list. Anyway, everybody that was on the don't be list was a boy in the classroom. And it didn't take you much to get on that list, which meant essentially that every boy in that class was living on thin ice with the teacher every day. And every girl was being praised for being able to sit there quietly and color and listen to the stories and not act out. Until we finally, there were a couple of us parents who said something because it just was getting so out of hand. And the boys just felt terribly guilty going to school every day. It wasn't fun.
And you say just they were just being boys. And I think that, you know, as school systems have cut down more and more on recess and phys ed class and things that are, I mean, it's actually gotten to be a very hostile place for boys.
I agree.
I can remember when I first found out I was pregnant with a boy, I first said, oh, my God, what am I going to do with a boy? I'll tell you what my second thought was. Oh, he's going to have so much an easier life being a male. And you know, that was in 1989, and I really, having him come home from school like your son, he's saying, Mom, you know what the girls did today, and if the guys had done that, we would have been in big trouble.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I want to also, one of the pieces of research that I did is that, you know, there are studies all over the world about how children are punished or not punished, and boys all over the world in all cultures are punished much more than girls.
Well, in our culture, certainly, I mean, you look at the prisons, and I want to get into that because I know that criminal behavior, a lot of the aberrant behavior that we read about in the news, that we can trace at least some of that back to not just the software of the brain, but the way in which our brains are hardwired, and when we, you know, a lot of the discussions about fidelity and about all of the famous cases of people who are serial philanderers and sex addicts.
There's a lot of guys out there giving a lot of men a bad name right now, aren't there?
Right. And a lot of guys who I don't think maybe they go into rehab and maybe they finally get counseling they need and maybe they finally have an understanding of what exactly is going on in their head and not just metaphorically. So I do want to get to that. And especially when it comes to violence and some other types of behaviors that run away with the male brain, but now are becoming more and more common with women as well. But I want to go back to this one other thought before we get to the bottom of the hour. And again, we're talking about the male brain. Dr. Luann Brizendine, is this idea that when the teenage years come around, that there's sort of this wildness that goes on in the male brain that's a little more unpredictable than in the female brain, although not taking anything away from what women go through or girls as they become women. But
I wrote a whole other book about that. So if any of your listeners want
it,
it's a different story. But, you know, I think you're right. The boys do go through a whole lot of things that are specific to boys at that time that are running their hormones. And the risk-taking behavior and the accidents that boys have, you know, the leading cause of death in teen boys is accidents.
Right. But I just want to say there's no pre-care for that. For as predictable as that is, and as, you know, millennia old as those behaviors are, you'd think that when a boy was 11 or 12 years old, or when parents were 11 or 12 years old, that there would actually be more active participation at the higher, you know, levels of our society to start.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think we're shirking our responsibilities as society at the 11, 12, 13 year old for the boys. We are not taking the responsibility we need to as a society to start doing things that help these boys.
Why do we have to keep rediscovering this every generation? Why can't we just say, all right, you know, it's sort of like in Star Trek. I don't know if you ever, where the boys are entering into the Punfar phase, you know, and so they've got to be able to, we have to prepare for what's going to be coming. And here are the typical things that your kids are going to start to do. And it's a great, you know, market for a book. And I think it's terrific. And parents should read The Male Brain. But also, we have to understand it as a society. And we have to be able to better control or be able to harness this kind of potential testosterone that overtakes a generation every day. And we'll get back to this coming up, and we'll talk about some of the criminal behaviors that we're reading about in the news, too, and how this could all go back to the male brain. Tonight, Dr. Lou Anne Brizendine on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. It's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett, and have a happy Easter weekend, if that's what you're celebrating. I want to say thanks to all the people in San Francisco celebrating WonderCon there that were so nice to my friend David Mack, who is in town signing some of his work, no doubt, for Kabuki or Daredevil, which I heard is going to be getting a cinematic makeover a la the Hulk movie, but I don't know that for sure. Anyway, coming this Wednesday to a comic book shop near you, my friend David Mack has the latest collaboration with some wonderful artists and the family of Philip K. Dick. The Electric Ant series is just coming out, graphic novel form, The Electric Ant, this Wednesday. And there's another story in the news that pertains directly to our subject tonight, about the male brain, about the complexities of the male brain, about how understanding the male brain leads us to at least a glimmer of hope on how to stop the same problems from recurring, how to maybe stop certain people from certain behaviors, which are destructive to themselves and to others, how to better understand what some of these pedophile priests are being driven by, for example. But it's the story, and I don't even know whether our guest, Dr. Lou Anne Brizendine, knows about this, but it's a story about how an electromagnetic jolt to your brain can temporarily impair your sense of morality, that you can control morality through an electromagnetic impulse. You get to hear about this coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Lou Anne Brizendine, medical doctor, researcher on the human brain, and our guest tonight, author of The Male Brain, A Breakthrough Understanding of How Men and Boys Think. So can I read you this news story from ABC News? You didn't have to catch it yesterday, did you?
Go ahead. Shoot.
This is from the words of Courtney Hutchison, who wrote, an electromagnetic jolt to your brain can temporarily impair your sense of morality. No, this isn't a comic book tale. Just the most recent research coming out of MIT's Moral Psychology Lab. Didn't know they had one.
Yeah.
In a study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers found that subjects were less able to judge the morality of others' actions when activity in the right temporal parietal junction, I know I'm pronouncing that wrong, a region of the brain located above the right ear, was disrupted by a strong magnetic field. Doctor, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that would give you some cause to keep out of strong magnetic fields, first of all. there are parts of our brain that are used to make judgments about what to do, what not to do, what behavior is good to do, what's not to do, what will get you in trouble, what's moral, what's immoral. We judge those things all the time. And any disruptions by electrical current or even by medications, like Valium and the medicines in that category, can do what it's almost like pushing the clutch in to your brain. And, you know, it's just the drivetrain that usually is going and making judgments and making assessments about your behavior is temporarily, the clutch is pushed in from either the medications or from these jolts of electromagnetic currents. Of course, you know, those are very strong, and you're not gonna find any place that you're walking around the world where that's gonna happen to you. You have to be in the laboratory, and they're applying that right to your scalp.
But listen to this here, and I'm gonna read a little bit more, and that's very interesting what you said. And I like the male-centric analogy of the clutch and the drivetrain. That's very good, because I totally get what you're talking about here. This suggests that there are multiple systems for morality, and that you can selectively target and impair one at a time. That, according to Lianne Young, the lead author of the study, The hope for moral psychologists is to discover the physical processes that give rise to moral decision and deconstruct morality by looking into the brain. In the study, researchers asked about 20 participants to read dozens of short narratives and rate the characters' actions on a scale of 1 to 7, 1 being forbidden and 7 being completely permissible. While the subjects read and decided, researchers disrupted the function of that RTPJ part of their brain using a powerful magnet. As a control, researchers would present similar moral questions without disrupting the brain. And what they found was, of course, is just what you're saying, that they about 15% more likely to make moral decisions. They struggled with making decisions which they would not have struggled with making before. And that's very intriguing because it goes to show you the relationship between the physical housing of the brain and our thought processes, which we kind of think of maybe as being sort of disembodied from the warehouse. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think one of the things I could tell your listeners and teach them about one principle only, if they can just remember this one thing, that is that all behavior comes from the brain.
Right.
So that moral behavior, criminal behavior, you know, sexual behavior, hunger, sleep, all of those things have circuitry in our brain that control those parts of our life. And there's a part of our brain for morality, and that's what the laboratory at MIT is trying to dissect, is trying to figure out exactly what parts of the brain have different aspects of morality that if you disengage them, you push the clutch in, and then they cannot actually function well. They can't drive the behavior towards a moral decision. So that we know that from lots of patients who have had strokes in certain areas over,
right,
you know, 50 years we've been studying that. Now we're learning new techniques like this one at MIT where you can disrupt a certain area. So all behavior comes from the brain.
And yet, we don't always think of it that way, much like we think of human emotions as coming from the heart or somehow. And so I think it's important because then conversely, in that analysis, if somebody was always acting immorally, isn't there hope that we might be able to get their foot off that clutch and get them to reengage the moral decision-making part of their brain?
Yes, and I think that's a really important point because, you know, and if you look into aspects of how the brain functions or doesn't function in disease states, then you learn a lot. And if you can learn how the normal brain functions, we all know that we can actually change our behavior. For example, you know, people are not born learning and knowing how to play the piano, right? That's not a skill you're born with. You do practice, practice, practice. And you train your muscles and your brain cells that control those muscles to do that thing. And you memorize pieces and your muscles know that piece of music, for example. You can train yourself to ski. You can train yourself to do basketball. You can train yourself to do many things. And you know, you can train yourself to have more and more moral behavior. And I think that's one of the big functions, actually, of any religion, is that they help train people to do more and more moral behavior.
Hopefully. And I want to get back to that. By the way, it goes on to say here, the magnet used by MIT researchers to disrupt brain activity is a special kind of technology, not a normal magnet, according to researchers. Quote, "You can't turn your little brother into a supervillain by making him wear a suit of refrigerator magnets. And I know that's true because if it had been possible, my older brother would have done that." So, which is to say, actually, to make a point that that there are some people, some children who are born, as the Buddhists would say, with old souls. And from a very early age, they seem to be very much at peace. They seem to make better moral decisions. They don't have to learn everything from trial and error. They seem to have kind of an innate sense of right and wrong and caring for one another. And then there are the new souls out there who have to touch, kick, you know, push everything over, run around three times, try to figure out what the world is like. How do we explain that through brains?
Yeah, I think you're pointing to something that this is not like a male or female brain thing. It's not like females are more moral than males and males are more.
Right.
It's part of, of course, male and female brains are more alike than they are different. After all, we are the same species. And so what you're talking about is, that different personalities are wired that way probably from birth.
How do we account for that difference, though, in what the Buddhists would say, old souls and new souls, people who are at peace, people who seem to be able to make better moral decisions, and children who just have to kind of work it all out by trial and error?
We don't know the answers to those questions. And what we do know in our field is that people seem to have very enduring personalities from the get-go. Young children's personality, all of our personalities, we know how we behave and how we don't behave, and we know areas of our weakness and strength, right, by the time we're, in our 20s or 30s. And young children have very early on, as you point out, certain personalities. And it's the one thing that little boys tend to have more of than little girls is they have more exploratory behavior. They need to run around a lot more. Little girls will do, they take the sword. I tell the story of I wanted to give gender neutral toys to my son. So I gave him his action figure at 4 years old for Christmas, but I also gave him wrapped up a Barbie doll, and he grabs her out of the box, seizes her by her torso and stabs her legs into the air like a sword.
Yeah. I remember there was a woman across the street from me when we first both started to have kids. And we just had our boy and we were kind of raising him like a typical kind of boy. But she was doing the whole gender neutral toy thing. And we were over for dinner one night. Or I think her son was about 6 months older than mine. We were playing it. And I was playing in his room, just kind of hanging out with him. And I said the G word, gun.
Oh, dear.
Which she caught me saying, and she came in and she said, "We don't say G-U-N around him. We're not teaching him that." And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And she said, "We're just going with gender neutral toys here. We're trying to train him." She said, "All he has are occupational toys." So I looked around and that's when I realized, oh yeah, everything here was based on kind of playtime. And he picked up a stethoscope when his mother walked out of the room. I'll never forget this. He picked up a stethoscope from a play doctor's kit and he looked at me and he went, "Bang, bang." With the stethoscope. I thought, okay, you're going to be okay, kid.
Yeah.
You're going to be.
I didn't teach him that. And a little girl, most typical little girls would not have done that.
Right. Right. We're talking about the male brain, Dr. Luann Brizendine. So let's go back to that moral thing. We were talking about religions and how the intent of religious institutions, of religious traditions, is to try to bring about a sense of morality that might differ. But usually it's about community. Some would say that the Bible itself is an answer to the very one of the first questions asked of God in the Bible is, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And that the rest of the Bible is really an elaborate answer to that question.
Absolutely. And we have areas in our brain, one of the which I talk about in the book called the RCZ, which is short for a long name, for rostrocaudal cingulate zone, and it is an area in our brain that scientists have discovered does things like the following. If you do something that's a behavior that's not approved of by your group, right, and you get feedback from other people that you've done something wrong and you've made a faux pas or a boo-boo, you start to fix your behavior because that little area almost gives you an internal shock. It gives you a little zap on the inside.
Right.
It basically tells you that you did something that's immoral or not appropriate for the group, or it's something that you did that's not sort of an agreed upon consensus of how human beings behave in their group.
But if we're going to go with that, and I like that, and I think this is important, where do we come down? How do we understand the human brain, the male brain, in regard to the story of these pedophiles or pederast priests who are out there who are supposedly teaching that morality, who would never teach that as part of the
right.
morality, that are still violating children, teenagers, adults, men and women, and doing it with a kind of flagrancy, and then in many cases, as we can tell according to the news stories and the lawsuits, that are being covered up along the way. Where's the disconnect in the brain that has the teachers and the maintainers of that tradition in small areas here being some of the biggest violators of that?
So, you know, I think I find this whole topic of the priests that have preyed upon these children just abhorrent. And of course, we have to be, you know, it's clear that it's not all priests.
Right.
Clearly not.
4, 10, whatever the under 10%, but that's still a lot.
But, yeah,
and where's
scary,
the disconnect?
It's very scary because they have special access to children. So,
right.
But you know, there's aberrant and criminal behavior that's called, you know, that's in the pedophile category, that pedophiles are obsessed with sex with children. That is, they become all of their brain areas for what they are attracted to sexually becomes, you know, perversely in the area of seeking sex with children. And unfortunately, there are those priests who are in that category and have perpetrated these crimes upon poor victim children.
Whether they're priests or doctors or disc jockeys or
right.
whatever, what is it that, what part of the human brain are we talking about, and what happens to the development?
In the normal human brain, let's say, you become, so in that, we talked about that teen boy stage between ages 9 and 15 when his sexual circuits get started to be fueled by all that testosterone.
Right.
That starts running their sexual circuits for, let's say, fantasizing about, you know, girls' body parts. And if that person is actually going to be a pedophile, at that same stage, they start having fantasies about whatever sexual object they are interested in.
Right.
In my field, there are people who have obsessions and sexual obsessions with shoes or with inanimate objects, right? I mean, that's categorized as a perversion.
A fetishist.
And sexual, attraction to children is in the category of perversion. So those categories are clearly possible behaviors in the human brain that are abnormal.
But what do we think happens brain-wise? Is that only a software issue, or does that come back to, again,
no, we believe it's
a hardwiring issue?
It's hard to know. I mean, people feel that it's this, you can't have a software without a hardware, right?
Right.
So you need both at once. But the current belief is that that the underlying engine is running the sexual desire piece that's the normal feeling of the human brain, but then the particular attraction may be a software problem, and that the feeling is that in some cases that can be fixed, and in some cases, sadly, it may not be able to be fixed, and those people need to be incarcerated, or they need, you know, in some states and various places, they are giving them what's called chemical castration.
Right, or if nothing else, total and complete isolation from that object which controls their moral decision making.
Right. So that's
yeah.
it's basically the human brain gone bad, so to speak.
Right. And I think a lot of what we try to understand when it comes to the male brain are how these people go bad. Can I ask you about the serial philanderers coming up? Can we do that?
We'll do that next. Sure.
Yeah. Men who have a hard time staying faithful. Men who have made a mental commitment, men who believe in the sanctity of marriage, but can't stop themselves, they say, from exploring that side of themselves, which desires to dominate other people, sometimes men, sometimes women, and to have as many, you know, sexual conquests as possible. Where in the human brain is that? And is there hope for people like Tiger Woods and Jesse James and other people who we read about who can't seem to have controlled that in the past? The Male Brain, a breakthrough understanding of how men and boys think. Dr. Lou Anne Brizendine next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.